Side 13, A Fire Upon the Deep, by Werner Venge. Continuing on page 287. After the static, she was much worse. On one occasion, she'd held control for almost a day around. Given a year without crises, Flenser could have studied tie and draw and fect and done a proper excision. Fect, the member with the white-tipped ears, was probably the one to kill. It wasn't bright, but it was likely the capstone of the trio. With a precisely crafted replacement, Flenser might even be greater than before the massacre at Parliament Bowl. But for now, Flenser was stuck. Soul surgery on oneself was an awesome challenge, even to the master. So, careful, careful. Keep the cloaks well charged, take no long trips, and don't let any one person see all the threads of your plan. While Steele thought he was seeking Rongelith, Flenser was talking to Omdi and Yefri. The human's face was wet with tears.
Four times we've missed Ravna. What has happened to her?
His voice screeched up. Flenser hadn't realized there was such flexibility in the belching mechanism that humans use to make sound. Most of Omdi clustered round the boy. He licked Yefri's cheeks.
It could be our ultra-wave. Maybe it's broken.
He looked beseechingly at Flenser. There were tears in the puppy's eyes, too.
Tyrethect, please ask Steele again. Let us stay in the ship all the day around. Maybe there are messages that have come through and not been recorded.
Flenser with Steele descended the northern stairs, crossed the parade ground. He gave a sliver of attention to the others' complaints about the sloppy maintenance around the practice stands. At least Steele was smart enough to keep the discipline scaffolds over on Hidden Island. Flenser with Rongelith's troopers splashed through a mountain stream. Even in high summer, in the middle of a dry wind, there were still snow patches, and the streams running from under them were icy cold. Flenser, with Omdi Yefri, edged forward, let two of Omdi rest against his sides. Both children liked physical contact, and he was the only one they had besides each other. It was all perversion, of course, but Flenser had based his life on manipulating others' weakness and, but for the pain, welcomed it. Flenser buzzed a deep purring sound through his shoulders, caressing the puppy next to him.
I'll ask our Lord Steele the very next time I see him.
Thank you.
A puppy nuzzled at his cloak, then mercifully moved away. Flenser was a mass of sores beneath that cover. Perhaps Omdi realized that, or perhaps... More and more, Flenser saw a reticence in the two. His comment to Steele had been a slip into the truth. These two really didn't trust him. That was Tyrethet's fault. On his own, Flenser would have had no trouble winning Omdi Yefri's love. Flenser had none of Steele's killing temper and fragile dignity. Flenser could chat for casual pleasure, all the while mixing truth with lies. One of his greatest talents was empathy. No sadist can aspire to perfection without that diagnostic ability. But just when he was doing well, when they seemed about to open to him, then Ty or Ra or Thecht would pop up, twisting his expression or poisoning his choice of phrase. Perhaps he should content himself with undermining the children's respect for Steele, without, of course, ever saying anything directly against him. Flenser sighed and patted Yefri's arm comfortingly.
Ravna will be back, I'm sure of it.
The human sniffled a little, then reached out to pet the part of Flenser's head that was not shrouded by the cloak. They sat in companionable silence for a moment, and his attention drifted back to the forest and Rongelith's troops. The group had been moving uphill for almost 10 minutes. The others were lightly burdened and used to this sort of exercise. Flenser's two members were lagging. He hissed at the group leader. The group leader sidled back, his squad shifting briskly out of his way. He stopped when his nearest was 15 feet from Flenser's. The soldiers' heads cocked this way and that.
Your wishes,
my lord."
This one was new. He had been briefed about the cloaks, but Flenser knew the fellow didn't understand the new rules. The gold and silver that glinted in the darkness of the cloaks, those colors were reserved for the lords of the domain. Yet there were only two of Flenser here. Normally such a fragment could barely carry on a conversation, much less give reasonable orders. Just as disconcerting, Flenser knew, was his lack of mind sound. Zombie was the word some of the troops used when they thought themselves alone. Flenser pointed up the hill. The timber line was only a few yards away. "Fire scout Rongolith is on the other side. We will take a shortcut," he said weakly. Part of the other was already looking up the hill.
"That is not good, sir,"
the trooper spoke slowly.
"Stupid damn duo," his posture said.
"The bad ones will see us." Flenser glowered at the other, a hard thing to do properly when you were just two.
"Soldier, do you see the gold on my shoulders? Even one of me is worth all of you. If I say take a shortcut, we do it, even if it means walking belly deep through brimstone."
Actually, Flenser knew exactly where Vendacious had put lookouts. There was no risk in crossing the open ground here, and he was so tired. The group leader still didn't know quite what Flenser was, but he saw the dark cloaks were at least as dangerous as any full pack lord. He backed off humbly, bellies dragging on the ground. The group turned uphill, and a few minutes later were walking across open heather. Rongolith's command post was less than half a mile away along this path. Flenser, with steel, walked into the inner keep. The stone was freshly cut, the walls thrown up with the feverish speed of all this castle's construction. 30 feet over their heads, where vault met buttresses, there were small holes set in the stonework. These holes would soon be filled with gunpowder, as would slots in the wall surrounding the landing field. Steele called those the jaws of welcome. Now he turned ahead back to Flenser.
"So, what does Rongolith say?"
"Sorry, he's been out on patrol. He should be here. I mean, he should be in camp any minute." Flenser did his best to conceal his own trips with the scouts. Such recons were not forbidden, but Steele would have demanded explanations if he knew. Flenser, with Rongolith's troops, sloshed through water-soaked heather. The air over the snowmelt was delightfully chill, and the breeze pushed cool tongues partway under his wretched cloak. Rongolith had chosen the site for his command post well. His tents were in a slight depression at the edge of a large summer pond. 100 yards away, a huge patch of snow covered the hill above them, fed the pond, and kept the air pleasantly cool. The tents were out of view from below, yet the site was so high in the hills that from the edge of the depression there was a clear view across 3 points of the compass, centered on the south. Resupply could be accomplished from the north with little chance of detection, and even if the dam fires struck the forest below, this post would be untouched. Far Scout Rongolith was lounging about his signal mirrors, oiling the aiming gears. One of his subordinates lay with snouts stuck over the lip of the hill, scanning the landscape with its telescopes. Rongolith came to attention at the sight of Flenser, but his gaze wasn't full of fear. Like most long-range scouts, he wasn't completely terrorized by castle politics. Besides, Flenser had cultivated an us-against-the-prigs relationship with the fellow. Now Rongolith growled at the group leader.
"The next time you come prancing across the open like that, your asses go on report."
"My fault, Far Scout," put in Flenser. "I have some important news." They walked away from the others down toward Rongolith's tent.
"See something interesting, did you?"
Rongolith was smiling oddly. He had long ago figured out that Flenser was not a brilliant duo, but part of a pack with members back at the castle.
"When is your next session with Cradleheads?"
That was the field name for Vendacious.
"Just past noon. He hasn't missed in 4 days. The Southerners seem to be on one big squat."
"That will change." Flenser repeated Steele's orders for Vendacious. The words came hard. The traitor within him was restive. he felt the beginnings of a major attack.
Wow! You're going to move everything over to Margrim Clime in less than two... Never mind. That's something I'd best not know.
Under his cloaks, Flenser bristled. There are limits to chumminess. Rongolith had his points, but maybe after all this was over, he could be smoothed into something less ad hoc.
Is that all, my lord?
Yes. No. Flenser shivered with uncharacteristic puzzlement. The trouble with these cloaks, sometimes they made it hard to remember things.
By the Great Pact, no.
It was that Tyrethect again. Steele had ordered the killing of Woodcarver's human. All things considered, a perfectly sensible move, but... Flenser with Steele shook his head angrily, his teeth clicking together.
"Something the matter," said Lord Steele.
He really seemed to love the pain that the radio cloaks caused Flenser.
"Nothing, my lord. Just a touch of the static."
In fact, there was no static, yet Flenser felt himself disintegrating. What had given the other such sudden power? Flenser with Omdi Yefri snapped his jaws open and shut, open and shut. The children jumped back from him, eyes wide.
"It's okay," he said grimly, even as his two bodies thrashed against each other.
There really were lots of good reasons why they should keep Johanna Olschendott alive. In the long run, it assured Jeffrey's goodwill, and it could be Flenser's secret human. Perhaps he could fake the two-legs death to steal and... No, no, no. Flenser grabbed back control, jamming the rationalizations out of mind. The very tricks he had used against Tyrethect, she thought to turn against him.
"It won't work on me. I am the master of lies."
And then her attack twisted again, became a massive bludgeoning that destroyed all thought. With Flenser, with Rongolith, with Omdi Yefri, all of him was making little gibbering noises now. Lord Steele danced around him, unsure whether to laugh or be concerned. Rongolith goggled at him in frank amazement. The two children edged back to touch him.
"Are you hurt? Are you hurt?"
The human slipped those remarkable hands under the radio cloak and brushed softly at Flenser's bleeding fur. The world blurred in a surge of static.
"No, don't do that. It might hurt him more," came Omdi's voice.
The puppy's tiny muzzles reached out, trying to help with the cloaks. Flenser felt his being pushed downwards towards oblivion. Tyrethect's final attack was a frontal assault, without rationalizations or sly infiltration, and she looked out upon herself in astonishment. "After so many days, I am me, and in control. Enough butchering of innocence. If anyone is to die, it is Steele and Flenser." Her head followed Steele's prancing forms, picked out the most articulate member. She gathered her legs beneath her and prepared to leap at its throat. Come just a little closer and die. Tyrethect's last moment of consciousness probably didn't last longer than 5 seconds. Her attack on the Flenser within her was a desperate, all-out thing that left her without reserves or internal defense. Even as she tensed to leap upon Steele, she felt her soul being pulled back and down, and Flenser rising up from the darkness. She felt the member's legs spasm and collapse, the ground smash into its face. And Flenser was back in control. The weakling's attack had been astonishing. She really had cared for the ones who were to be destroyed, cared so much she was willing to sacrifice herself if it would kill Flenser. And that had been her undoing. Suicide is never something to hang pack dominance on. Her very resolve had weakened her hold on the hind mind and given the master his chance. He was back in control, and with a great opportunity. Tyrethect's assault had left her defenseless. The innermost mental barriers around her three members were suddenly as thin as the skin of an overripe fruit. Flenser slashed through the membrane, pawed at the flesh of her mind, spattering it across his own. The three who had been her core would still live, but never again would they have a soul separate from his. Flenser with steel sprawled as though unconscious, his convulsions subsiding. Let Steele think him incapacitated, it would give him time to think of the most advantageous explanation. Flenser with Rongelith came slowly to his feet, though the two members were still in a posture of confusion. Flenser pulled them together. No explanations were due here, but it would be best if Farscout didn't suspect soul strife. The cloaks are powerful tools, dear Rongelith, sometimes a bit too powerful.
Yes, my lord.
Flenser let a smile spread across his features. For a moment he was silent, savoring what he would say next. No, there was no sign of the weak-willed one. This had been her last, best try at domination, her last and biggest mistake. Flenser's smile spread further, all the way to the two with Omdi Efri. It suddenly occurred to him that Johanna Olschendott would be the first person he had ordered killed since his return to Hidden Island. Johanna Olschendott would therefore be the first blood on three of his muscles. There's one more item for Cradlehead's Farscout. An execution. As he spoke the details, the warmth of a decision well made spread through his members. Chapter 35. The only good thing about all the waiting had been the chance it gave the wounded. Now that Vendacious had found a way past the Flenserist defenses, everyone was anxious to break camp, but Johanna spent the last afternoon at the field hospital. The hospital was laid off in rough rectangles, each about 6 meters across. Some of the plots had ragged tents, those belonging to wounded who were still smart enough to care for themselves. Others were surrounded by stranded fencing. Inside each of those was a single member, the survivor of what had once been an entire pack. The singletons could easily have jumped the fences, but most seemed to recognize their purpose and stayed within. Johanna pulled the food cart through the area, stopping at first one patient and then another. The cart was a bit too large for her, and sometimes it got caught in the roots that grew across the forest floor. Yet this was a job that she could do better than any pack, and it was nice to find a way she could help. In the forest around the hospital, there was the sound of care hogs being coaxed up to wagon ties, the shouts of crews securing the cannons and getting the camp gear stowed. From the maps Vendacious had shown at the meeting, it was clear the next 2 days would be an exhausting time, but at the end of it, they would have the high ground behind unsuspecting Flenserists. She stopped at the first little tent. The threesome inside had heard her coming and was outside now, running little circles around her cart. "Johanna! Johanna!" it said in her own voice. This was all that was left of one of Woodcarver's minor strategists. Once upon a time, it had known some Somnorsh. The pack had originally been six. Three had been killed by the wolves. What was left was the talker part, about as bright as a five-year-old, though with an odd vocabulary. "Thank you for food, thank you." Its muzzles pushed at her. She patted the heads before reaching into the cart and pulling out bowls of lukewarm stew. Two of them dug in right away, but the third sat back for a moment and chatted. "I hear we fight soon." "Not you anymore, but..." "Yes, we are going up by the dry fall just east of here." "Uh-oh," it said. "Uh-oh, that's bad. Poor seeing, no control. Ambush scary." Apparently the fragment had some memories of its own tactical work. But there was no way Johanna could explain Vendacious's reasoning to it. "Don't worry. We will make it okay." "You sure? You promise?" Johanna smiled gently at what was left of a rather nice fellow. "Yes, I promise." Okay. Now all three had their muzzles stuck into stew bowls. This was one of the lucky ones, really. It showed plenty of interest in what went on around it. Just as important, it had childlike enthusiasms. Pilgrim said that fragments like this could grow back easily if they were just treated right long enough to bear a puppy or two. She pushed the cart a few meters further to the fenced square that was the symbolic corral for a singleton. There was a faint odor of shit in the air. Some of the singletons and duos were not housebroken. In any case, the camp latrines were 100 meters away.
"Here, Blackie. Blackie?"
Johanna banged an empty bowl against the side of the cart. A single head eased up from behind some root bushes. Sometimes this one didn't respond even that much. Johanna got on her knees, so her eyes weren't much higher than the black-faced one.
"Blackie?"
The creature pulled himself out of the bushes and slowly approached. This was all that was left of one of Scrupolo's cannoneers. She vaguely remembered the pack, a handsome sixum, all large and fast. But now even Blackie wasn't whole. A falling gun had crushed his rear legs. He dragged his legless rear on a little wagon with 30-centimeter wheels, sort of like a scroter rider with four legs. She pushed a bowl of stew toward him and made the noises that Pilgrim coached her in. Blackie had refused food the last 3 days, but today he rolled and walked close enough that she could pet his head. After a moment, he lowered his muzzle to the stew. Johanna grinned in surprised pleasure. This hospital was a strange place. A year ago, she would have been horrified by it. Even now, she didn't have the proper tiny shop look on the wounded. As she continued to pet Blackie's lowered head, Johanna looked across the forest floor at the crude tents, the patients and parts of patients. It really was a hospital. The surgeons did try to save lives, even if the medical science was a horrifying process of cutting and splinting without anesthetics. In that regard, it was quite comparable to the medieval human medicine that Johanna had seen on Dataset. But with the Tynes, there was something more. This place was almost a spare parts warehouse. The medics were interested in the welfare of packs. To them, singletons were pieces that might have a use in making larger fragments workable, at least temporarily. Injured singletons were at the bottom of all medical priorities. "There's not much left to save in such cases," one medic had said to her via Pilgrim. "And even if there was, would you want a crippled, loose-bonded member in yourself?" The fellow had been too tired to notice the absurdity of his question. His muzzles had been dripping blood. He'd been working for hours to save wounded members of whole packs. Besides, most wounded singletons just stopped eating and died in less than a 10-day. Even after a year with Tynes, Johanna couldn't quite accept it. Every singleton reminded her of dear Scriber. She wanted them to have a better chance than his last remnant had. She had taken over the food cart and spent as much time with the wounded singletons as she did with any of the other patients. It had worked out well. She could get close to each patient without mind-sound interference. Her help gave the Brugkenners more time to study the fragments and singletons and try to build working packs from the wreckage. And now maybe this one wouldn't starve. She'd tell Pilgrim. He'd done miracles with some of the other matchups and seemed to be the only pack who shared some of her feelings for damaged singletons.
"If they don't starve, it often means a strength of mind. Even crippled, they could be an advantage to a pack," he'd said to her. "I've been crippled off and on in my travels. You can't always pick and choose when you're down to 3 and you're 1,000 miles into an unknown land."
Johanna set a bowl of water beside the stew. After a moment, the crippled member turned on his axle and took some shallow sips.
"Hang on, Blackie. We'll find someone for you to be."
Kitarata was where he was supposed to be, walking his post exactly as expected. Nevertheless, he felt a thrill of nervousness. He always kept at least one head gazing at the mantis creature, the two legs. Nothing suspicious about that posture, either. He was supposed to be doing security duty here, and that meant keeping a lookout in all directions. He shifted his crossbow nervously about from jaws to field pack and back to jaws. Just a few more minutes. Keterate circled the hospital compound once more. It was soft duty. Even though this stretch of wood had been spared, the dry wind fires had chased the bigger wildlife downstream. This close to the river, the ground was covered with soft bush, and there was scarcely a thorn to be found. Pacing around the hospital was like a walk on woodcarver's green down south. A few hundred yards east was harder work, getting the wagons and supplies in shape for the climb. The fragments knew that something was up. Here and there, heads stuck up from pallets and burrows. They watched the wagons being loaded, heard the familiar voices of friends. The dumbest ones felt a call to duty. He had chased three able-bodied singles back into the compound. No way such Phoebes could be of any help. When the army marched up Margrim Climb, the hospital would stay behind. Keterate wished he could, too. He'd been working for the boss long enough to guess whence his orders ultimately came. Keterate suspected that not many would be coming back from Margrim Climb. He turned three pairs of eyes toward the mantis creature. This latest job was the riskiest thing he'd been a part of. If it worked out, he might just demand that the boss leave him with the hospital. Just be careful, old fellow. Vendacious didn't get where he is by leaving loose ends. Keterate had seen what happened to that Easterner who nosed a little too close into the boss's business. Damn, but the human was slow. She'd been grunting at that one singleton for 5 minutes. You'd think she was having sex with these frags for all the time she spent with him. Well, she'd pay for the familiarity very soon. He started to cock his bow, then thought better of it. Accident. Accident. It must all look like an accident. Aha! The two legs was collecting food and water bowls and stowing them on the meal cart. Keterate made unobtrusive haste around the hospital perimeter, positioning himself in view of the Kratzy duo, the fragment that would actually do the killing. Kratzy Nisi Nari had been a foot trooper before losing the Nisi Nari parts of himself. He had no connection with the boss or security. But he'd been known as a crazy-headed get of bitches, a pack that was always on the edge of combat rage. Getting killed back to two members normally had a gentling influence. In this case, well, the boss claimed that Kratzy was specially prepared, a trap ready to be sprung. All Keterate need do was give the signal, and the duo would tear the mantis apart. A great tragedy. Of course, Keterate would be there, the alert hospital warden. He would quickly put arrows through Kratzy's brains, but alas, not in time to save the two legs. The human dragged the meal cart awkwardly around root bushes toward Kratzy, her next patient. The duo came out of its burrow, speaking half-witted greetings that even Keterate could not understand. There were undertones, though, a killing anger that edged its friendly mien. Of course, the mantis thing didn't notice. She stopped the cart, began filling food and water bowls, all the time grunting away at the twosome. In a moment, she would bend down to put the food on the ground. For half an instant, Keterate considered shooting the mantis himself if Kratzy were not immediately successful. He could claim it was a tragic miss. He really didn't like the two legs. The mantis creature was a menacing thing. It was so tall and moved so weirdly. By now, he knew it was fragile compared to packs, but it was scary to think of a single animal so smart as this. He shelved the temptation even faster than he had thought it. No telling what price he might pay for that, even if they believed his shot was an accident. No altruism today, thank you very much. Kratzy's jaws and claws would have to do. One of Kratzy's heads was looking in Keterate's general direction. Now the mantis picked up the bowls and turned from the meal cart. Hi, Johanna,
How is it going?
Johanna looked up from the stew to see Peregrine Wickrackscar walking along the edge of the hospital. He was moving to get as close as possible without invading the mind sounds of the patients. The guard who had stopped there a moment before retreated before his advance and stopped a few meters further on.
Pretty good, she called back. You know the one on wheels? He actually ate some stew tonight.
Good. I've been thinking about him and the threesome on the other side of the hospital.
The wounded medic?
Yes. What's left of Trelalock is all female, you know. I've been listening to mind sounds and...
Pilgrim's explanation was delivered in fluent Somnorish, but it didn't make much sense to Johanna. Brugkenning had so many concepts without reference in human language that even Pilgrim couldn't make it clear. The only obvious part was that since Blackie was a male, there was a chance that he and the medic threesome might have pups early enough to bind the group. The rest was talk of mood resonance and meshing weak points with strong. Pilgrim claimed to be an amateur at brood kenning, but it was interesting the way the docks, and even woodcarver sometimes, deferred to him. In his travels, he had been through a lot. His matchups seemed to take more often than anybody's. She waved him to silence.
Okay, we'll try it soon as I've fed everybody.
Pilgrim cocked a head or two at the nearby hospital plots.
Something strange is going on. Can't quite put my finger on it, but all the fragments are watching you, even more than usual. Do you feel it?
Johanna shrugged.
No.
She knelt to set the water and stew bowls before the twosome patient. The pair had been vibrating with eagerness, though they had been quite polite and not interrupting. Out of the corner of her eye, she noticed the hospital guard make a strange dipping motion with its two middle heads and... The blows were like two great fists smashing into her chest and face. Johanna fell to the ground, and they were on her. She raised bloody arms against the slashing jaws and claws. When Keterate gave the signal, both of Kratzy leaped into action, crashing into each other, almost incidentally knocking the Mantis on her back. Their claws and teeth were tearing at empty air and each other as much as the two legs. For an instant, Keterate was struck motionless with surprise. She might not be dead. Then he remembered himself and jumped over the fence at the same time cocking and loading his bow. Maybe he could miss the first shot. Kratzy was shredding the Mantis, but slow. Suddenly, there was no possibility of shooting the twosome. A wave of snarling black and white surged over Kratzy and the Mantis. Every able-bodied fragment in the hospital seemed to be running to the attack. It was instant killing rage, far wilder than anything that could come from whole packs. Keterate fell back in astonishment before the sight and the mind sound of it. Even the pilgrim seemed caught up in it. The pack raced past Keterate and circled the melee. The pilgrim never quite plunged in, but nipped here and there, screaming words that were lost in the general uproar. A splash of coordinated mind sound boomed out from the mob, so loud it numbed Keterate 20 yards away. The mob seemed to shrink in on itself, the frenzy gone from most of its members. What had been near a single beast with 2 dozen bodies was suddenly a confused and bloody crowd of random members. The pilgrim still ran around the edge, somehow keeping his mind and purpose. His huge, scarred member dived in and out of the remaining crowd, clawing at anything that still fought. The patients dragged themselves away from the killing ground. Some that had gone in as threesomes or duos came out single. Others seemed more numerous than before. The ground that was left was soaked with blood. At least 5 members had died. Near the middle, a pair of prosthetic wheels lay incongruously. The pilgrim paid it all no attention. The 4 of him stood around and over the bloody mound at the center. Keterate smiled to himself. Mantis splatter. Such a tragedy. Johanna never quite lost consciousness, but the pain and the suffocating weight of dozens of bodies left no room for thought. Now the pressure eased. Somewhere beyond the local den, she could hear shouts of normal, tinish talk. She looked up and saw Pilgrim standing all around her. Scarbutt was straddling her, its muzzle centimeters away. It reached down and licked her face. Johanna smiled and tried to speak. Vendacious had arranged to be in conference with Scrupolo and Woodcarver. Just now, the commander of cannoneers was deep into tactics, using dataset to illustrate his scheme for Margrim Climb. Squalls of rage sounded from down by the river. Scrupolo looked up peevishly from the pink oliphant.
"What the muddy hell?"
The sounds continued, more than a casual brawl. Woodcarver and Vendacious exchanged worried glances, even as they arched necks to see among the trees.
"A fight in the hospital," said the queen.
Mendacious dropped his noteboard and lunged out of the meeting area, shouting for the local guards to guard the queen. As he raced across the camp, he could see that his roving guards were already converging on the hospital. Everything seemed as smooth as a program on dataset, except why so much noise? The last few hundred yards, Scrupolo caught up with him and pulled ahead. The cannoneer raced into the hospital and stumbled over himself in abrupt horror. Vendacious burst into the clearing, all prepared to display his own shock, combined with alert resolve. Peregrinwick Raxgar was standing by a meal cart, Kitarate not far behind him. The pilgrim was standing over the two legs and the litter of carnage. By the pack of packs, what happened? There was too much blood by far.
"Everybody back except the doctors," Vendacious bellowed at the soldiers who crowded at the edge of the compound. He picked his way along a path that avoided the loudest-minded patients. There were a lot of fresh wounds, and here and there speckles of blood dark on the pale tree trunks. Something had gone wrong. Meanwhile, Scrupolo had run around the edge of the hospital and was standing just a few dozen yards from the pilgrim. Most of him was staring at the ground under Wick Raxgar. "It's Johanna! Johanna!" For a moment, it looked like the fool would jump over the fence.
"I think she's okay, Scrupolo," Wick Raxgar said. "She was just feeding one of the duos, and it went nuts, attacked her."
One of the doctors looked over the carnage. There were three corpses on the ground, and blood enough for more.
"I wonder what she did to provoke them." "Nothing, I tell you. But when she went down, half the hospital went after what's-its here."
He waggled a nose at unidentifiable remains. Vendacious looked at Kitarate, at the same time saw Woodcarver arrive.
"What about it, soldier?" he asked.
"Don't screw up, Kitarate."
It's just like the pilgrim says, my lord. I've never seen anything like it."
He sounded properly astounded by the whole affair. Vendacious stepped a little closer to the pilgrim.
"If you'll let me take a closer look, pilgrim."
Wick Raxgar hesitated. He had been snuffling around the girl, looking for wounds that might need immediate attention. Then the girl nodded weakly to him, and he backed off. Vendacious approached, all solemn and solicitous. Inside, he raged. He'd never heard of anything like this. But even if the whole damn hospital had come to her aid, she should still be dead. The Crotsey duo could have ripped her throat out in half a second. His plan had seemed foolproof, and even now the failure would cause no lasting damage. But he was just beginning to understand what had gone wrong. For days, the human had been in contact with these patients, even Crotsey. No Tynish doctor could approach and touch them like the two legs. Even some whole packs felt the effect. For fragments, it must be overwhelming. In their inner soul, most of the patients considered the alien part of themselves. He looked at the two legs from three sides, mindful that the eyes of 50 packs were watching his every move. Very little of the blood was from the two legs. The cuts on her neck and arms were long and shallow, aimless slashings. At the last minute, Crotsey's conditioning had failed before the notion of the human as pack member. Even now, a quick flick of a forepaw would rip the girl's throat open. He briefly considered putting her under security medical protection.
The ploy had worked well with Scriber, but it would be very risky here. Pilgrim had been nose to nose with Johanna. He would be suspicious of any claims about unexpected complications. No, even good plans sometimes fail. Count it as experience for the future. He smiled at the girl and spoke in Somnorsh. You're quite safe now, for the moment, and quite unfortunately. The human's head turned to the side, looking off in the direction of Kitarate. Scrupulo had been pacing back and forth along the fence, so close to Kitarate and Pilgrim that the two had been forced back. I won't have it, the cannoneer said loudly. Our most important person attacked like this. It smells of enemy action. Wick Rakskar goggled at him. But how? I don't know, Scrupulo said, his voice a desperate shout. But she needs protection as much as nursing. Vendacious must find some place to keep her. The pilgrim pack was clearly impressed by the argument, and unnerved. He inclined a head at Vendacious and spoke with uncharacteristic respect. What do you think, Vendacious? Of course Vendacious had been watching the two legs. It was interesting how little humans could disguise their point of attention. Johanna had been staring at Kitarate. Now she was looking up at Vendacious, her shifty little close-set eyes narrowing. Vendacious had made a project this last year of studying human expressions, both on Johanna and in stories and dataset. She suspected something, and she also must have understood part of Scrupulo's speech. Her back arched and raised one hand weakly. Fortunately for Vendacious, her shout came out a whisper that even he could scarcely hear.
No, not like Scriber.
Vendacious was a pack who believed in careful planning. He also knew that the best-made schemes must be altered by circumstances. He looked down at Johanna and smiled with the gentlest public sympathy. It would be risky to kill her like Scriber's frag, but now he saw that the alternatives were far more dangerous. Thank goodness Woodcarver was stuck with her limper on the other side of the camp. He nodded at Pilgrim and drew himself together.
I fear Scrupulo is right. Just how it might have been done, I don't know, but we can't take a chance. We'll take Johanna to my den. Tell the Queen.
He pulled cloaks from his backs and began gently to wrap the human for the last trip she would ever make. Only her eyes protested. Johanna drifted in and out of consciousness, horrified at her inability to scream her fears. Her strongest cries were less than whispers. Her arms and legs responded with little more than twitches, even that lost in Vendacious's swaddling. Concussion, maybe, something like that. The explanation came from some absurdly rational corner of her mind. Everything seemed so far away, so dark. Johanna woke in her cabin at Woodcarver's. What a terrible dream. That she had been so cut up, unable to move, and then thinking Vendacious was a traitor. She tried to shrug herself to a sitting position, but nothing moved.
Darn sheets are all wrapped around me.
She lay quiet for a second, still massively disoriented by the dream.
Woodcarver?
She tried to say, but only a little moan came out. Some member moved gently around the fire pit. The room was only dimly lit, and something was wrong with it. Johanna wasn't lying in her usual place. There was a moment of puzzled lassitude as she tried to make sense of the orientation of the dark walls. Funny. The ceiling was awfully low. Everything smelled like raw meat. The side of her face hurt, and she tasted blood on her lips. She wasn't at Woodcarver's, and that terrible dream was... Three tinish heads drifted in silhouette nearby. One came closer, and in the dim light she recognized the pattern of white and black on its face. Vendacious. Good, he said. You are awake.
Where am I?
The words came out slurred and weak. The terror was back.
The abandoned cutter's hut at the east end of the camp. I've taken it over, as a security den, you know.
His Somnorsh was quiet and fluent, spoken in one of the generic voices of Dataset. One of his jaws carried a dagger, the blade aglint in the dimness. Johanna twisted in the tied cloaks and whispered screams. Something was wrong with her. It was like shouting on empty breath. One of Vendacious paced the hut's upper level. Daylight splashed across its muzzle as it peered out first one and then another of the narrow slits cut in the timbers.
Ah, it's good that you don't pretend. I could see that you somehow guessed about my second career, my hobby. But screaming, even loud, won't help either. We have only a brief time to chat. I'm sure the Queen will come visiting soon, and I will kill you just before she arrives. So sad. Your hidden wounds were tragically severe.
Johanna wasn't sure of all he said. Her vision blurred every time she moved her head. Even now, she couldn't remember the details of what had happened back in the hospital compound. Somehow, Vendacious was a traitor, but how? Memories wriggled past the pain.
You did murder Scriber, didn't you? Why?
Her voice came louder than before, and she choked on blood dribbling back down her throat. Soft, human laughter came from all around her.
He learned the truth about me. Ironic that such an incompetent would be the only one to see through me. Or do you mean a larger why?
The three nearby muzzles moved closer still, and the blade in one's jaw patted the side of Johanna's cheek.
Poor two legs. I'm not sure you could ever understand. Some of it, the will to power, maybe. I've read what Dataset has to say about human motivation, the Freudian stuff. We Tynes are much more complicated. I am almost entirely male, did you know that? A dangerous thing to be, all one sex. Madness lurks. Yet it was my decision. I was tired of being an indifferently good inventor, of living in Woodcarver's shadow. So many of us are her get, and she dominates most all of us. She was quite happy about my going into security, you know. She doesn't quite have the combination of members for it. She thought that all male but one would make me controllably devious. His sentry member made another round of the window slits. Again there was a human chuckle. I've been planning a long time. It's not just Woodcarver I'm up against. The power side of her soul is scattered all over the Arctic coast. Flenser had almost a century head start on me. Steele is new, but he has the empire Flenser built. I made myself indispensable to all of them. I'm Woodcarver's chief of security. And Steele's most valued spy. Played aright, I will end up with the Dataset and all the others will be dead.
His blade tapped her face again.
Do you think you can help me?
Eyes peered close into her terror.
I doubt it very much. If my proper plan had succeeded, you would be neatly dead now.
A sigh breathed around the room.
But that failed, and I'm stuck with carving you up myself. Perhaps it will turn out for the best. Dataset is a torrent of information about most things, but it scarcely acknowledges the existence of torture. In some ways, your race seems so fragile, so easily killable. You die before your minds can be dismembered, yet I know you can feel pain and terror. The trick is to apply force without quite killing.
The three nearby members snuggled into more comfortable positions like a human settling down for serious talk.
And there are some questions you may be able to answer, things I couldn't really ask before. Steele is very confident, you know, and it's not just because he has me with Woodcarver. That pack has some other advantage. Could he have his own data set?
Vendacious paused. Johanna didn't answer, her silence a combination of terror and stubbornness. This was the monster that killed Scriber. The muzzle with the knife slid between the blankets and Johanna's skin, and pain shot up Johanna's arm. She screamed.
Ah, Dataset said a human could be hurt there. No need to answer that one, Johanna.
Do you know what I think is Steele's secret? I think one of your family survived. Most likely your little brother, considering what you've told us about the massacre. Jeffrey? Alive? For an instant, she forgot the pain, almost forgot the fear. How? Vendacious gave a tiny shrug. You never saw him dead. You can be sure Steele wanted alive two legs, and after reading about cold sleep and data set, I doubt he could have revived any of the others. And he's got something up there. He's been eager for information from data set, but he's never demanded that I steal the device for him. Johanna closed her eyes, denying the traitor pack's existence. Jeffrey lives. Memories rose before her. Jeffrey's playful joy, his childish tears, his trusting courage aboard the refugee ship. Things she had thought forever lost to her. For a moment, they seemed more real than the slashing violence of the last few minutes. But what could Jeffrey do to help the Flenserists? The other data sets had surely burned. There's something more here, something that Vendacious still is missing. Vendacious grabbed her chin and gave her head a little shake. Open your eyes! I've learned to read them, and I want to see... I don't know if you believe me or not. No matter. If we have time, I will learn just what he might have done for Steele. There are other, sharper questions. Dataset is clearly the key to all. In less than half a year, I and Woodcarver and Pilgrim have learned an enormous amount about your race and civilization. I dare say we know your people better than you do. When all the violence is over, the winner will be the pack that still controls Dataset. I intend to be that pack. And I've often wondered if there are other passwords or programs I can run that would actually watch for my safety. The babysitter code. The watching heads bobbed a grin. Aha! So there is such a thing. Perhaps this morning's bad luck is all for the best. I might never have learned... His voice broke into discords. Two of Vendacious jumped up to join the one already at the window slits. Softly, by her ear, the voice continued, It's the Pilgrim, still far away, but coming toward us. I don't know. You would be much better safely dead, one deep wound all out of sight. The knife slid further down. Johanna arched futilely back from the point. Then the blade withdrew, the point poised gently against her skin. Let's hear what Pilgrim has to say. No point in killing you this instant if he doesn't insist on seeing you. He pushed a cloth into her mouth and tied it tight. There was a moment of silence, maybe the crunch of paws in the brush right around the cabin. Then she heard a pack warble loud from beyond the timbered walls. Johanna doubted that she would ever learn to recognize packs by their voices, but... Her mind stumbled through the sounds, trying to decode the tinyish chords that were words piled on top of one another. Johanna! Something! Interrogative. Screech! Safe. Vendacious gobbled back. Hail, Peregrine Wickrackscar! Johanna Trill! Not visible hurts, sad uncertain squeak. And the traitor murmured in her ear... Now he'll ask if I need medical help, and if he insists, our chat will have an early end. But the only reply Pilgrim made was a chorus of sympathetic worry.
Damn assholes are just sitting down out there, came Vendacious's irritated whisper.
The silence stretched on a moment, and then Peregrine's human voice, the Joker from Dataset, said in clear Somnorsh,
Don't do anything foolish, Vendacious, old man.
Vendacious made a sound of polite surprise and tensed around her. His knife jabbed a centimeter deep between Johanna's ribs, a thorn of pain. She could feel the blade trembling, could feel his member's breath on her bloody skin. Pilgrim's voice continued, confident and knowing.
I mean we know what you're up to. Your pack at the hospital has gone completely to pieces, confessed what little he knew to Woodcarver. Do you think your lies can get by her? If Johanna is dead, you'll be bloody shreds.
He hummed an ominous tune from Dataset.
I know her well, the Queen. She seems such a gracious pack. But where do you think Flenser got his gruesome creativity? Kill Johanna, and you'll find just how far her genius in that exceeds Flenser's.
The knife pulled back. One more of Vendacious leaped to the window slits, and the two by Johanna loosened their grip. He stroked the blade gently across her skin, thinking, is Woodcarver really that fearsome? The four at the windows were looking in all directions. No doubt Vendacious was counting guard packs and planning furiously. When he finally replied, it was in Somnorsh.
The threat would be more credible if it were not at second hand.
Pilgrim chuckled.
True, but we guessed what would happen if she approached. You're a cautious fellow. You'd have killed Johanna instantly and been full of lying explanation before you even heard what the Queen knows. But seeing a poor pilgrim amble over, I know you think me a fool, only one step better than Scriber Jacques Ramafan.
Peregrine stumbled on the name and for an instant lost his flippant tone.
Anyway, now you know the situation. If you doubt, send your guards beyond the brush. Look at what the Queen has surrounding you. Johanna dead only kills you. Speaking of which, I assume this conversation has some point. Yes, she lives.
Vendacious slipped the gag from Johanna's mouth. She turned her head, choking. There were tears running down the sides of her face.
Pilgrim! Oh, Pilgrim!
The words were scarcely more than a whisper. She drew a painful breath, concentrated on making noise. Bright spots danced before her eyes.
Hi, Pilgrim!
Hi, Johanna! Has he hurt you?
Some, I...
That's enough. She's alive, Pilgrim, but that's easily corrected.
Vendacious didn't jam the gag back in her mouth. Johanna could see him rubbing heads nervously as he paced round and round the ledge. He trilled something about stalemated game.
Peregrine replied, Speak Somnorsh, Vendacious. I want Johanna to understand, and you can't talk quite as slick as in pack talk.
Whatever. The traitor's voice was unconcerned, but his members kept up their nervous pacing.
The Queen must realize we have a standoff here. Certainly I'll kill Johanna if I'm not treated properly. But even then, Woodcarver could not afford to hurt me. Do you realize the trap Steele has set on Margrim Climb? I'm the only one who knows how to avoid it. Big deal. I never wanted to go up Margrim anyway. Yes, but you don't count, Pilgrim. You're a mongrel patchwork. Woodcarver will understand how dangerous this situation is. Steele's forces are everything I said they weren't, and I've been sending them every secret I could write down from my investigations of Dataset.
My brother is alive, Pilgrim, Johanna said.
Oh, you're kind of a record-setter for treason, aren't you, Vendacious? Everything to us was a lie while Steele learned all the truth about us.
You figure that means we daren't kill you now?
Laughter and Vendacious's pacing stopped. He sees control coming back to him.
More. You need my full membered cooperation. See, I exaggerated the number of enemy agents in Woodcarver's troops, but I do have a few, and maybe Steele has planted others I don't know about. If you even arrest me, word will get back to the Flenser armies. Much of what I know will be useless, and you'll face an immediate overwhelming attack. You see?
The Queen needs me.
And how do we know this is not more lies?
That is a problem, isn't it? Batched only by how I can be guaranteed safety once I've saved the expedition. No doubt it's beyond your mongrel mind. Woodcarver and I must have a talk, someplace mutually safe and unseen. Carry that message back to her. She can't have this traitor's hides, but if she cooperates, she may be able to save her own. There was silence from outside, punctuated by the squeaking of animals in the nearer trees. Finally, surprisingly, Pilgrim laughed.
Mongrel mind, eh? Well, you have me in one thing, Vendacious. I've been all the world round, and I remember back 50,000 years. But of all the villains and traitors and geniuses, you take the record for bald impudence.
Vendacious gave a tinish chord, untranslatable, but as a sign of smug pleasure.
I'm honored.
Very well, I'll take your points back to the Queen. I hope the two of you are clever enough to work something out. One thing more. The Queen requires that Johanna come with me.
The Queen requires? That sounds more like your mongrel sentiment to me.
Perhaps, but it will prove you are serious in your confidence. View it as my price for cooperation.
Vendacious turned all his heads toward Johanna, silently regarding.
Then he scanned out all the windows one last time.
Very well, you may have her.
Two jumped down to the cabin's hatch while another pair pulled her toward it. His voice was soft and near her ear.
Damn, Pilgrim. Alive, you're just going to cause me trouble with the Queen.
His knife slid across her field of view.
Don't oppose me with her. I am going to survive this affair, still powerful.
He lifted back the hatch, and daylight spilled blindingly across her face. She squinted. There was a sweep of branches and the side of the hut. Vendacious pushed and pulled her cot onto the forest floor, and at the same time gobbling at his guards to keep their positions. He and Peregrine chatted politely, agreeing on when the Pilgrim would return. One by one, Vendacious trotted back through the cabin's hatch. Pilgrim advanced and grabbed the handles at the front of the cot. One of his pups reached out from his jacket to nuzzle her face.
You okay?
I'm not sure. I got bashed in the head, and it seems kind of hard to breathe.
He loosened the blankets from around her chest as the rest of him dragged the cot away from the hut. The forest shade was peaceful and deep, and Vendacious's guards were stationed here and there about the area. How many were really in on the treason? 2 hours ago, Johanna had looked to them for protection. Now their every glance sent a shiver through her. She rolled back to the center of the cot, dizzy again, and stared up into the branches and leaves and patches of smoke-stained sky. Things like Straumly tree squigglies chased each other back and forth, chittering and seeming to bait. Funny. Almost a year ago, Pilgrim and Scriber were dragging me around, and I was even worse hurt and terrified of everything, including them. And now, she had never been so glad to see another person. Even Scarbutt was a reassuring strength walking beside her. The waves of terror slowly subsided. What was left was an anger as intense, though more reasoning, than the year before. She knew what had happened here. The players were not strangers. The betrayal was not random murder. After all Vendacious's treachery, after all his murders, and his planning to kill them all, he was going to go free. Pilgrim and Woodcarver were just going to overlook that.
He killed Scriber, Pilgrim. He killed Scriber.
He cut Scriber to pieces, then chased down what was left and killed that right out of our arms.
And Woodcarver is going to let him go free? How can she do it? How can you do it?
The tears were coming again.
Shh, shh.
Two of Pilgrim's heads came into view. They looked down at her, then swiveled around almost nervously. She reached out, touching the short plush fur. Pilgrim was shivering. One of him dipped close. His voice didn't sound jaunty at all.
I don't know what the Queen will do, Johanna. She doesn't know about any of this.
What?
Shh.
And his voice became scarcely a buzzing through her hand.
His people can still see us. He could still figure things out. Only you and I know, Johanna. I don't think anyone else suspects.
But the Pacta confessed?
Bluff. All bluff. I've done some crazy things in my life, but next to following Scriber down to your starship, this takes the prize. After Vendacious took you away, I began to think. You weren't that badly injured. It was all too much like what happened to Jacques Ramathan, but
but I had no proof.
And you haven't told anyone?
No. Foolish as poor Scriber, aren't I?
His heads looked in all directions.
If I was right, he'd be silly not to kill you immediately. I was so afraid I was already too late.
You would have been, if Vindicius weren't quite the monster I know he is.
Anyway, I'd learned the truth just like poor Scriber, almost by accident. But if we can get another 70 meters away, we won't die like him. And everything I claimed to Vindicius will be true.
She patted his nearest shoulder and looked back. The tiny cabin and its ring of guards disappeared behind the forest brush. And Yeffrey lives. Crypto Zero. 95 encrypted packets have been discarded. As received by Elvira, shipboard ad hoc. Language path, Tredesk to Trisqualine, SJK units. From Zonograph, Eidolon. Co-op, or religious order, in the middle beyond, maintained by subscription of several thousand low beyond civilizations, in particular those threatened by immersion. Subject, Surge Bulletin, Update and Ping. Distribution, Zonograph, Eidolon subscribers, Zonometric Interest Group, Threats Interest Group, Subgroup, Navigational Ping Participants. Date, 1,087,892,301 seconds since calibration event, 239,011 Eidolon frame, 66.91 days since fall of Chandra K. Key phrases, galactic scale event, superluminal, charitable emergency announcement. Text of message. Please include accurate local time in any ping responses. If you receive this, you know that the monster's surge has receded. The new zone surface appears to be a stable froth of low dimensionality between 2.1 and 2.3. At least 5 civilizations are trapped in the new configuration. 30 virgin solar systems have achieved the beyond. Subscribers may find specifics in the encrypted data that follow this bulletin. The change corresponds to what is seen in a normal period of 2 years across the whole galaxy's slow zone surface. Yet this surge happened in less than 200 hours and on less than 1,000th of that surface. Even these numbers do not show the scale of the event. The following can only be estimates, since so many sites were destroyed and no instruments were calibrated for this size event. At its maximum, the surge reached 1,000 light-years above zone surface standard. Surge rates of more than 30 million times light-speed, about 1 light-year per second, were sustained for periods of more than 100 seconds. Reports from subscribers show more than 10 billion softened deaths directly attributable to the surge. Local network failures, failures leading to environment collapse, medical collapse, vehicle crashes, security failures. Posted economic damage is much greater. The important question now is what can we expect in after surges? Our predictions are based on instrumented sites and zonometric surveys, combined with historical data from our archives. Except for long-term trends, predicting zone changes has never been a science, but we have served our subscribers well in advising of after-surges and in identifying available new worlds. Unfortunately, the present situation makes all previous work almost useless. We have precise documentation going back 10 million years. Faster-than-light surges happen about every 20,000 years, usually with speed under 7.0 C. Nothing like this monster is on file. The surge just seen is the kind described at third hand in old and glutted databases. Sculptor had one this size 50 million years ago. The Perseus arm in our galaxy probably suffered something like this 500 million years ago. This uncertainty makes our mission nearly impossible and is an important reason for this public message to the Xenometry News Group and others. Everyone interested in xenometry and navigation must pool resources on this problem. Ideas, archive access, algorithms, all these things could help. We pledge significant contributions to non-subscribers and one-for-one trades to those with important information. Note, we are also addressing this message to the Swindwip Oracle and direct beaming it to points in the Transcend thought to be inhabited. Surely an event such as this must be of interest even there. We appeal to the powers above. Let us send you what we know. Give us some hint if you have ideas about this event. To demonstrate our good faith, here are the estimates we have currently. These are based on naive scale-up of well-documented surges in this region. Details are in the non-cryptid appendix to this sending. Over the next year, there will be 5 or 6 after-surges of diminishing speed and range. During this time, at least 2 more civilizations, see risk list, will likely be permanently immersed. Zone storm conditions will prevail even when after-surges are not in progress. Navigation in the volume coordinate specification will be extremely dangerous during this period. We recommend that shipping in the volume be suspended. The timeline is probably too short to admit feasible rescue plans for the civilizations at risk. Our long-range prediction, probably the least uncertain of all, the million-year scale secular shrinkage will not be affected at all. The next 100,000 years will, however, show a retardation in the shrinkage of the slow zone boundary in this portion of the galaxy. Finally, a philosophical note. We of Zonographic Eidolon watch the zone boundary and the orbits of border stars. For the most part, the zone changes are very slow, 700 meters per second in the case of the long-term secular shrinkage. Yet these changes, together with orbital motion, affect billions of lives each year. Just as the glaciers and droughts of a pre-technical world must affect a people, so must we accept these long-term changes. Storms and surges are obvious tragedies, near instant death for some civilizations, yet these are as far beyond our control as the slower movements. Over the last few weeks, some news groups have been full of tales of war and battle fleets, of billions dying in the clash of species. To all such, and those living more peaceably around them, we say, look out on the universe. It does not care, and even with all our science, there are some disasters that we cannot avert. All evil and good is petty before nature. Personally, we take comfort from this, that there is a universe to admire that cannot be twisted to villainy or good, but which simply is. Crypto Zero, as received by Elvira Shipboard Ad Hoc. Language Path, Arbwith to Trade 24, to Cherguelen, to Trisqueline, SJK units. From Twirlip of the Mists. Who knows what this is, though probably not a propaganda voice. Very sparse priors. Subject, the cause of the recent great surge. Distribution, threat of the blight, great secrets of creation. Zonometric interest group. Date, 66.47 days since fall of Chandra K. Key phrases, zone instability and the blight, hexapodia as the key insight. Text of message. Apologies if I am repeating obvious conclusions. My only gateway onto the net is very expensive and I miss many important postings. The great surge, now in progress, appears by all accounts to be an event of cosmic scope and rarity. Furthermore, the other posters put its epicenter less than 6,000 light-years from recent warfare related to the blight. Can this be mere coincidence? As has long been theorized, citations from various sources, 3 unknown to Elvira, the theories cited are of long-standing and non-disprovable. The zones themselves may be an artifact, perhaps created by something beyond transcendence for the protection of lesser forms or, hypothetical, sentient gas clouds in galactic cores. Now, for the first time in Nit history, we have a transcendent form, the Blight, that can effectively dominate the Beyond. Many on the Nit, Sites, Hans, and Shandor at the zoo, believe that it is searching for an artifact near the bottom. Is it no wonder that this could upset the natural balance and provoke the recent event? Please write to me and tell me what you think. I don't get much mail. Crypto Zero, as received by Elvira, shipboard ad hoc. Language path, Baileresque to Trisqueline, SJK units. From Alliance for the Defense. Claimed union of five empires below Straumli realm. No references prior to the fall of the Straumli realm. Numerous counterclaims, including from Out of Band 2, that this alliance is a front for the old Aprahant hegemony. Compare Butterfly Terror. Subject: courageous mission accomplished. Distribution: Threat of the Blight, War Trackers Interest Group, Homo Sapiens Interest Group. Date: 67.07 days since fall of Chandra K. Key phrases: action, not talk. Text of message: subsequent to our action against the human nest at Chandra K, a part of our fleet pursued human and other blight-controlled forces toward the bottom of the Beyond. Evidently, the perversion hoped to protect these forces by putting them in an environment too dangerous to challenge. That thinking did not count on the courage of Alliance commanders and crews. We can now report the substantial destruction of those escaping forces. The first major operation of your alliance has been an enormous success. With the extermination of their most important supporters, blight encroachment on the Middle Beyond has been brought to a standstill. Yet much remains to be done. The Alliance fleet is returning to the Middle Beyond. We've suffered some casualties and need substantial reprovisioning. We know that there are still scattered pockets of humanity in the Beyond, and we've identified secondary races that are aiding humanity. The defense of the Middle Beyond must be the goal of every sophant of goodwill. Elements of your Alliance fleet will soon visit systems in the volume parameter specification. We ask for your aid and support against what is left of this terrible enemy. Death to Vermin. Chapter 36. Kjet Svensendott was alone on Elvira's bridge when the surge passed. They had long since done all the preparations that were meaningful, and the ship had no realistic means of propulsion in the slowness that surrounded it. Yet the group captain spent much of his time up here, trying to program some sort of responsiveness into the automation that remained. Half-assed programming was a time filler that, like knitting, must date to the beginning of the human experience. Of course, the actual transition out of slowness would have been totally unnoticed if not for all the alarms he and the Dirachmes had installed. As it was, the noise and lights blew him out of a half-drowse into hair-raised wakefulness. He punched the ship's comm. Glimfrella, Tirola, get your tails up here. By the time the brothers reached the command deck, preliminary nav displays had been computed and a jump sequence was awaiting confirmation. The two were grinning from ear to ear as they bounced in and strapped themselves down at action posts. For a few moments, there was little chit-chat, only an occasional whistle of pleasure from the Dirachmes. They had rehearsed this over and over during the last 100-plus hours, and with the poor automation, there was a lot for them to do. Gradually, the view from the deck's window sharpened. Where at first there had only been vague blurs, the ultrawave sensors were posting individual traces with steadily improving information on range and rates. The communication window showed the queue of fleet comm messages getting longer and longer. Tirola looked up from his work. "Hi, boss. These jump figures look okay, at least as a first cut." "Good. Commit and allow auto-commit." In the hours after the surge, they had decided that their initial priority should be to continue with the pursuit. What they did then, they had talked long on that, and Group Captain Svensendott had thought even longer. Nothing was routine anymore. "Yes, sir," The Dairakami's long fingers danced across the controls, and Rolla added some verbal control. Bingo! Status showed 5 jumps completed. 10. Kiet stared out the true view window for a few seconds. No change. No change. Then he noticed that one of the brightest stars in the field had moved, was sliding imperceptibly across the sky, like a juggler getting her pace. Elvira was coming up to speed.
Hi, hi.
Glimfrella leaned over to see his brother's work.
We're making 1.2 light-years per hour. That's better than before the surge.
Good. Calm and surveillance?
Where was everybody else, and what were they up to?
Yup, yup. I'm on it.
Glimfrella bent a slender frame back to the console. For some seconds, he was almost silent. Spensendot began paging through the mail. There was nothing yet from owner Lemonda. 25 years Kiet had worked for Lemonda and SJK Commercial Security. Could he mutiny? And if he did, would any follow?
Okay, here's the situation, boss.
Glimfrella shifted the main window to show his interpretation of the ship's reports.
It's like we guessed, maybe a little more extreme.
They had realized almost from the beginning that the surge was bigger than anything in recorded history. That's not what the Dairakami meant by extreme. He swept his short fingers down, making a hazy blue line across the window.
We guessed that the leading edge of the surge moved normal to this line. That would account for it taking Boss Lemonda out 400 seconds before it hit the out-of-band and hitting us 10 seconds after that. Now, if the trailing edge were similar to ordinary surges, upgraded a million times, then we, and then the rest of the pursuing fleets, should come out well before out-of-band.
He pointed at a single glowing dot that represented the Elvira. Around and just ahead of it, dozens of points of light were popping into existence as the ship's detectors reported seeing the initiation of ultra-drive jumps. It was like a cold fire sweeping away from them into the darkness. Eventually, Lemonda and the heart of the anonymous fleet would all be back in business.
Our pickup log shows that's about what happened. Most all the pursuing fleets will be out of the surge before they out of band.
So it'll lose part of its lead.
Yup. But if it's going where we think,
a G-star 80 light-years ahead of the fugitive,
it'll still get there before they kill it.
He paused, pointed at a haze that was spreading sideways from the growing knot of light.
Not everybody is still chasing.
Yeah.
Spensendot had been reading the news even as he listened to Frella's summary.
According to the net, that's the Alliance for the Defense departing the battlefield victorious.
Say what?
Tarola twisted abruptly in his harness. His large dark eyes held none of their usual humor.
You heard me.
Kiet put the item where the brothers could see it. The two read rapidly. Frella mumbling phrases aloud.
Courage of Alliance commanders. Substantial destruction of escaping forces.
Glimfrella shuddered, all flippancy departed.
They don't even mention the surge.
Everything they say is a cowardly lie. His voice shifted up to its normal speaking range, and he continued in his own language. Kiet could understand parts of it. The Dairakamis that left their dream habitats were normally light-hearted folk, full of whimsy and gentle sarcasm. Glimfrella sounded almost that way now, except for the high edges to his whistling and the insults more colorful than Svensendot had ever heard from them.
Get from a verminous cow pie. Killers of innocent dreams.
Even in Somnorsh, the words were strong, but in Dairakami,
verminous cow pie
was drenched in explicit imagery that almost brought the smell of such a thing into the room. Glimfrella's voice went higher and higher, then beyond the human register. Abruptly he collapsed, shuddering and moaning low. Dairakamis could cry, though Svensendot had never seen such a thing before. Glimfrella rocked in his brother's arms. Tarola looked over Glimfrella's shoulder at Kiet.
Where does revenge take us now, Group Captain?
For a moment, Kiet looked back silently.
I'll let you know, Lieutenant. He looked at the displays.
Listen and watch a little longer, and maybe we'll know.
Meantime, get us nearer the center of pursuit, he said gently.
Aye, sir.
Tirola patted his brother's back gently and returned to his console. During the next 5 hours, Elvira's crew watched the Alliance fleet race helter-skelter for the higher spaces. It could not even be called a retreat, more a panicked dissolution. Great opportunists, they had not hesitated to kill by treachery and to give chase when they thought there might be treasure at the end. Now that they were confronted with the possibility of being trapped in the slowness, of dying between the stars, they raced for their separate safety. Their bulletins to the news groups were full of bravado, but their maneuver couldn't be disguised. Former neutrals pointed to the discrepancy. More and more it was accepted that the Alliance was built around the Aprahati hegemony, and perhaps had other motives than altruistic opposition to the Blight. There was nervous speculation about who might next receive Alliance attention. Major transceivers still targeted the fleets. They might as well have been on a network trunk. The news traffic was a vast waterfall, totally beyond Elvira's present ability to receive. Nevertheless, Fensendot kept an eye on it. Somewhere there might be some clue, some insight. The majority of war trackers and threats seemed to have little interest in the Alliance or the death of Chandra Kay. Per se, most were terrified of the blight that was still spreading through the top of the beyond. None of the highest had successfully resisted, and there were rumors that two more interfering powers had been destroyed. There were some, secret mouths of the Blight, who welcomed the new stability at the top, even one based on permanent parasitization. In fact, the chase down here at the bottom, the flight of the out-of-band and its pursuers, seemed the only place where the Blight was not completely triumphant. No wonder they were the subject of 10,000 messages an hour. End of Side 13. To continue, turn the cassette over.